You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 139, our 18th question and answer episode. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you? Did you have a good Christmas?
We did. It was a lot of fun. All the kids were at home, so that's always good when we get everybody together and kind of watch the expression on people's faces.
Yeah.
You know, for the gifts. So, yeah, it was fun.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I had a Christmas gift. I won the Super Bowl for our Naked Bible League.
Oh, my.
The champion is here.
That's tragic.
I am your 2016 Naked Bible Fantasy Football League champion.
Yeah.
Please, everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Send me your praises at TreyStrickland@gmail.com. Don't hold
right. Back. Maybe we'll just torpedo the league next year.
What is it? I mean, I'm the champion. How does it feel to be on a show with a true champion? I mean, do you feel different? I kind of feel different.
I just think I had an out-of-body experience here.
This is the wrong podcast for that.
Right. Yeah, we can talk about that on Pure Normal.
Yeah, there you go. Are you doing anything fun for New Year's? Got any New Year's resolution? 2017? You give us your pretty book. Can you give us a...
You're asking me if I do something for fun. Of course not. You should know better.
Right. Just studying, right? Reading, writing. Grading
papers.
Yeah,
probably. No, I don't have to do any grading. So I could sit at my desk with the productivity pug on my lap and just think about the fact that I'm not grading, and that would be fun.
Well, how productive is 2017?
It's a pretty low bar.
And we've got one book coming out in the spring.
Yeah.
Another book possibly.
I'm not anticipating much in the way of production. It's not looking very well. If people subscribe to the newsletter, see, this is the kind of thing I do in the newsletter. I'm not going to like publicly lament on the blog. I'm going to give in the next issue of the newsletter, which should come out any day now. I sort of have this year in review, which on the one hand looks, you know, people read it. Oh, wow. You know, you guys did a lot this year. You know, Mike was productive. Mike looks at it and thinks, yeah, Mike should have done three, you know, literally two times as much. So, and I try to explain the math to people that, yeah, I really could. If I was doing this full time, I literally could do two to three times as much. So that's always when I get a question like, what does 2017 look like? That's what filters, you know, the answer.
Well, that's why we need you listeners out there to help support Mike and the podcast and the show, McLott. And, you know, our goal is to get Mike to do this full time so he can produce this content full time and a lot more than what we're used to. So if you're interested in getting more, please, I do not want to wait another decade for Unseen Realm 2.
So help
me out on that, listeners, please, Naked Nation out there. Let's try to get as much help as we can.
Go ahead. Yeah. I was going to say, you know, if people do subscribe to the newsletter, I mean, I literally just lay out the math, and I'll give you the quick version here. Because of my day job at Logos, I know precisely what I can produce in word count per day, because that's part of what I've done over the years. I can easily do 2,000 words a day. It sounds like a lot, but it's like five pages in Microsoft Word. Okay, at my day job, I've gone 4 or 5 months doing that every day, day after day after day after day. You know, and if you do that, I mean, that comes out to 3 books a year. So I look at that and say, that's what I ought to be doing in addition to the podcasts. And, you know, if I was doing this full time, we could do video. We could do a lot of things. So that's always what's floating around in my head, what I know I could do. And then I always, you know, kind of look at what gets done because I don't have the time. And it's just depressing. So thanks for asking.
Please go out there and support this show. And again, this is a Q&A for you new listeners. This is a question and answer episode where Mike will answer your questions. You can send your questions to me at TreyStrickland@gmail.com. You get that on NakedBiblePodcast.com. And Mike, I guess.
Let me break in again. I mean, this is a good example. We should be doing a Q&A every week. You know, it's just time. It's just logistics, you know.
Probably do a Q&A every day with as many questions that
yeah,
you...
Don't, yeah, Don't give me the number.
I mean, every episode, we probably get 1,000 questions just on one episode. So, I mean,
That's awesome.
My bad. All right. Well, let's just get to it and knock these questions out. Are you ready?
All right. Yeah, I'm ready.
Our first one is from Chris. And here's his question. I have heard your teaching that the creation accounts are not scientific descriptions, but polemics using pre-modern ancient Near Eastern cosmology. That makes perfect sense. Do you read the account of Noah's flood in the same way? Namely, that the setting assumes certain ancient Near Eastern conceptions of geography, cosmology.
Yeah, this actually takes us into territory where, you know, one of the online courses I teach, the first assignment is always to do a word study on the terminology in the flood story. And students are assigned, I don't care what position they take, but the assignment is, can a local or regional flood view be defended exegetically, you know, from the text? And so part of what I want them to see, what I want them to ask themselves when they go through that assignment, is really to think about context. Now, I say that to get us into the subject, because I'd say the account presumes the known world at the time, which would mean it isn't global like we think of global. So it's not about taking certain parts of the description and saying, oh, the mountains, you know, here, do they do this or that? Is this how people would have looked at mountains? Or look, it's just the world at the time is given to us in the Bible, and specifically it's given to us in Genesis 10. So really, one of the key questions, you know, to approaching this question and just generally interpreting the flood account is Genesis 10 the correct context or part of the correct context for interpreting Genesis 6 through 8? And if you're not familiar with Genesis 10, Genesis 10 gives us the nations known to the biblical writers. It actually lists them out. And you're not going to find nations elsewhere in the Bible that are found outside the geographical parameters. In other words, it's basically the world of the Mediterranean, you know, a little bit maybe beyond what the Greeks knew as the Pillars of Hercules and all that stuff, you know, into what is now Spain and stretching over toward, you know, what is India. But basically the Mediterranean world, which includes parts of Africa, you know, Middle East, and again, out stretching out toward, you know, what might be the northernmost parts at most, you know, of India or something like that. But that's the known world at the time. And so Genesis 10 lists a bunch of nations. If you plot them on a map, like you can get any Bible software, any study Bible, that this is the picture that's going to emerge. So the question is, should that chapter inform our understanding of how we read the flood account? And I would say, yeah, it should, because those nations are the ones that extend from Noah's sons that survived the flood. So if that's part of our context, then it's very evident that we should be reading, you know, the biblical flood in light of that context. So I'm not talking about science, or science isn't even on the table here. We're just asking, what is the correct context for the biblical writer? So if you're gonna look at that, well, it's kind of obvious, you know, that this is their world to them, and if they're writing about a flood that affects, you know, this region, then for the writer, that's the world, quote unquote. But we know, again, that it's not the globe, you know, because there's lots of other nations like Australia, North and South America that aren't within these parameters. Now, beyond that, you know, there are other things to consider here that people often don't think about as far as, you know, how to approach the flood narrative. I would say we need to also consider the vocabulary of the flood account. This is where that assignment that I give people in this class, you know, comes in, especially the phrases that those who take a global view, in other words, they want to read the flood account, you know, and say it's global like we think. There are certain phrases that sort of drive that argument. And I ask people to fix, you know, their minds on those phrases, because there's more to them than what you would think. Now, you know, before I go on here, you could argue that, well, the intent of the passage of the flood description, the intent was, you know, all the world. And so we could take that the flood story and say, well, we're going to use the intent as sort of the context by which to frame the discussion. Okay, you know, that's certainly, you know, could be on the table. But if you just take, you know, Genesis 10 by its lonesome and use that as the context for interpreting the flood, then you're going to come out with a local or regional event. So there's, you know, these are interpretive decisions. These are hermeneutical decisions. Neither thing is totally self-evident, you know, in how we should think about what we're thinking about, you know, when it comes to this. But anyway, you know, back to the phrases. What I'm talking about here is phrases like all the earth or the whole heaven or all flesh. These are phrases that take the word kol in Hebrew, all, every, or whole is what it means. And then it combines it with a word like eretz, land or earth, or basar, flesh, you know, all flesh, you know, all earth, the whole earth, all the earth, or shemayim, the whole heavens, or something like that. If you search those identical phrases through the Hebrew Bible, you will find the identical phrases occur a number of times. And within those hits, there are clear instances where the context dictates that the phrase should not be understood in terms of exhaustive totality. Let me give you some examples. Let's go with kol and eretz, okay, all the earth or the whole earth, shows up in Genesis 2:11. This is the description of, you know, Eden, the name and the four rivers. The name of the first is Pishon. It flows around the whole kol land, eretz, all the earth of Havilah, where there is gold. Well, are we really being asked to believe that every place in Havilah was infiltrated by this river, like every square inch of it, you know, is you know, runs, there's a tributary or something, some part of this river that runs through it? Well, obviously not. Or you wouldn't really have any arable, you wouldn't have any dry land. Are we supposed to say that, you know, the kol eretz of Havilah, again, all the land of Havilah, was surrounded by this river? In other words, the river surrounded the entire region, the entire place called Havilah? Again, you can't get exhaustive totality in the context of that verse. It occurs in Genesis 2:13, where it's the Gihon, again, these four rivers with Eden. 1 Samuel 14:25, here's the verse. And all, kol, the land, eretz, all the earth, all the land entered the forest, and there was honey on the ground. Now, the word kol, again, presumes people here in the context. We're talking about, you know, a mass of people going into the forest, okay? So are we to presume that every last person of the earth, of the land, or let's just make it the land of Israel to not be ridiculous, but every last person in the land of Israel went into that forest? Well, of course not. You know, obviously not. You know, Isaiah 14:7, the whole kol, earth, eretz, is at rest and is quiet. Really? Like no human or animal in the entire globe was making a sound? I mean, you could just go on and on, you know, with these sorts of phrases. Abraham to Lot, Genesis 13:9, is not the whole kol, land, eretz, the whole earth, the whole land before you? No, I would suggest it wasn't, because Lot isn't looking at the entire globe, nor could he. Lot's not standing there with Abraham and seeing Australia. So these phrases, in many places, do not, they cannot speak to exhaustive totality. The same thing with kol basar, all flesh. So we have here, let me just, you know, run a search here and look at a few of these. Joel 2:28. Let's just take a look at one here. And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, kol basar. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions. If you're going to say that that's exhaustive totality, then every person on earth is going to receive the Holy Spirit. But that isn't the case. Only believers do. So, but this phrase, again, is something that occurs right in the Genesis account. So I would suggest, you know, again, I don't really care. This is on my list of issues that I have to muster interest to really care about whether someone is a global flutter or a local regional flutter. I don't really care. I only care when people tie it to salvation or someone's view of inerrancy, because I can go for a long time going through, you know, scripture. I could be standing in front of an auditorium full of people and just running searches and showing you the exact phrases in context where they cannot mean exhaustive totality. And then the question is very simple. Is it okay to take these instances of these phrases where they don't mean exhaustive totality? Is it okay to use them as the hermeneutical filter then for the flood account and argue for a regional flood? People would say, no, no, that's illegitimate. You can't do that. And then it's very easy. I could just say, well, of course I can, because of Genesis 10. Genesis 10 is not all the nations of the globe. It's all the nations that they knew, which is regional. Again, it's not difficult to argue for a local regional event and have a really text-based argument for that that has nothing to do. I didn't even bring up science. I don't care what science says. I'm not a scientist. Doesn't amount a hill of beans to me. I don't use science as a hermeneutical tool. What I just gave you was text-based information. You know, we could go to the chronology of the flood account. Here's one. You know, I'll be done with this after this. I don't want to belabor it too much. But if you look at the flood account, now listen, I'm going to read a few verses to you. See if you catch a problem here. Genesis 8:3, the water receded steadily from the earth. At the end of 150 days, the water had gone down. And in verse 5, Genesis 8, we read, and the water decreased steadily until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains became visible. Next verse, then it came about at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. And he sent out a raven, and it flew here and there until the water dried up from the earth. Okay, that was verse 7. Now I'm in verse 8. Then he sent out a dove from him to see if the water was abated from the face of the land. Next verse. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot. So she returned to him into the ark, for the water was on the face of all the earth, the kol eretz. Then he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark himself. Now, do you see the problem? Genesis 8:9 tells us that the water was on the face of all the earth, the kol eretz. But 40 days earlier, the water had receded sufficiently for the mountains to be visible. And so the water wasn't really on the face of the entire earth. The face of the entirety of the earth was not covered in Genesis 8:9, even though that's the way the language sort of makes it sound. Kol eretz. So even here, the vocabulary, this phrase, does not mean exhaustive totality. Again, I could go a long time, you know, going through stuff like this. I don't really care. I don't make it an issue of, you know, my own, you know, how I look at, you know, somebody's, you know, commitment to inspiration or anything like that. But a lot of people do. And all I'm saying is, you know, that's kind of a mistake to do that. So I hope that illustrates the question and also answers it, but illustrates it, that it's not just a... it's not just an ancient Near Eastern thing, even though the cosmology is part of it. The sort of pre-modern cosmology, that's part of the picture. But part of the picture as well, if you want to argue for a local regional view, this is how you would do it. I just modeled it for you. This is how you would make a text-based argument for it, using the text of Scripture to do so. But you know, I don't really care one way or the other.
All right, we got another question from another Chris. And he's troubled by Psalm 137:9, and I'm certain a lot of people are. But his question is, why is it okay to say, quote, blessed shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock, unquote. This is directed at the children of Babylon. Crushing the skulls of babies sounds like an atrocity, not judgment. It isn't merely descriptive, but rather a blessing upon the murder of babies.
Yeah, this imprecation, I mean, it's very easy, you know, for us to look at that and sort of view this as an isolated event, you know, with sort of no context. But the logic of it, I mean, it's poetic language, which doesn't mean that the psalmist isn't really wishing it, because the psalmist is wishing for, you know, his enemies to be judged. You know, whether that means every last person or not is a different issue, different but related issue. But let's just, you know, take the language for what it is. My view of imprecation, and I'll be honest, I think we've had this question maybe a long, long time ago, or we did it somewhere. I can't remember what it was, maybe in the series in Leviticus. But my view, I'll be honest, is a minority position. And it's not an insignificant one, though, but it is going to be a minority position. So in a nutshell, I look at imprecatory prayer as deriving from the Abrahamic covenant, okay, Genesis 12, 1 through 3. And in that passage, God himself tells Abraham that he will curse anyone who curses him, you know, treats him lightly, and his descendants. You know, in other words, God's children. So if someone, you know, treats them with contempt, God says, I'm going to judge them. So when the psalmist or anyone else prays for God to judge people, even killing them, even killing their relatives or their children, the basis of wanting that to happen, there's a context to it. And specifically in Psalm, you know, 139, I mean, the questioner brought up Babylon. Babylon had a long, long, long history of, again, being the bad guy in the Old Testament, specifically, you know, toward the people of God, toward Israel. So the psalmist is, in effect, asking God to remember Genesis 12, 1 through 3. The psalmist is not going to take the matter into his own hands. What imprecatory prayers and imprecatory psalms really mean is that the person is angry or in anguish and saying, God, I want you to remember that you said those who do X, Y, Z to us, those who treat us with contempt, you will judge, you will curse them. I am asking you to do that. I'm asking you to remember this covenantal promise and take care of business. You know, even to the nth degree, even to these, you know, horrific, you know, sort of over the top kind of descriptions. But the psalmist is not going to act on that emotion. The psalmist is asking God to take care of the problem, to judge the evildoer in whatever way God sees fit. And I think that all of this, that's important, because at the heart of it, it's not a biblical justification for you to get angry at someone and lash out at them. It's actually the opposite. It's a biblical injunction for you to tell God just how you feel, even in really, you know, dark terms. You know, you're telling God just how you feel. In the case of the Israelites, I mean, they'd seen all this happen to them, you know, 100 times over. You know, if we're going through the book of Ezekiel, this is the kind of stuff you get that, especially in an episode, I think it might have been the last episode with the Assyrians. I mean, it gets even worse than that. And this is what they had experienced. And so for the psalmist to say, what gives? God, you need, you know, now to turn around. I mean, you could say, well, I get it. You know, we apostatized. We went and worshiped other gods. This is what happens. But that doesn't take away the Abrahamic covenant. The psalmist wants justice, you know, in the end, on the basis of this covenant. And so that's what imprecation is really about. Now, Christians, you know, the question comes up, what about Christians? You know, should we pray these kind of prayers? You know, should we vent this way? Like the people in the Old Testament did. I would say yes, because Christians are the inheritors of the Abrahamic covenant. That is explicitly stated in Galatians 3. So it stands to reason we can ask God to judge our enemies as well. What we can't do is judge our enemies ourselves. We're not supposed to take matters into our own hands. So these prayers at their very heart are pleas to God in very visceral language for God to judge evil, God to judge the people who are doing bad things to his kids, his children, for God to remember the original promise, Genesis 12, 1 to 3, and do something about it. And then you just leave it up to God. Imprecation is not a justification for a Christian or anyone, whether it was an Old Testament Israelite either, for taking matters into their own hands. And they're, you know, that's just, I think, how we need to frame the discussion. It's up to God how he will remove and judge those who oppress and curse his children. That's up to God. It might be something mild God decides to do, or it may, you know, be something harsh. But that's up to God. That's his job description, and it's not ours. And I would suggest, I really don't think that there are, you know, really any coherent alternatives to take the language seriously, but yet realize that the psalmist isn't asking God permission, you know, to do these things themselves. They're just using the most, you know, again, visceral language that you can use. but they're leaving it up to God ultimately. And if God judges the Babylonians a different way, then that's up to God. And the person praying the prayer has to be content with the way God took care of the situation. And it may not be what they want or what they're feeling, but God lets people emote. God lets people tell him exactly how they feel. But the key here is you let God decide. You let God decide what's best. I think, lastly, we also kind of get a little offended, by the language. We need to remember that the divine warrior imagery from the Old Testament. And that's not just Old Testament. We've talked about this before in the podcast, where the description of God as a warrior on the behalf of his children, Israel specifically, that stuff, like in Psalm 68, just plucking out an example, there are a number of divine warrior passages. That language in the Old Testament does, in fact, get applied to Jesus in the New Testament. And that's the reason for that is the vision of the Messiah coming back at the day of the Lord to judge the nations, to judge Israel's enemies. And if you look at Day of the Lord passages, people are going to lose their lives. It's going to be violent. It's going to be bad. But that isn't the only way that God judges, but that's part of the picture. So, at the return of the Lord, at the day of the Lord, the return of Christ, he is not coming back blowing kisses, right? He is cast as the judge of the nations. And that's his job to decide how evil gets judged. But he allows us, he allows the psalmist, and I would say us as well, to vent. He knows who we are. He knows we're human. He allows us to vent. But the venting is supposed to leave the matter with him and not take things into our own hands.
All right. Our next question is from Rusty in Oklahoma. And my question is about women in Matthew's genealogy, Bathsheba. I am wondering if there is any significance to her name being called Bathsheba in 1 Chronicles 3. It reminds me of Judah's wife, Shua, from 1 Chronicles 2. So I wonder if there's more to the reference, since Tamar is mentioned in Matthew's genealogy and not Shua. The thing I am impressed by this connection is the lack of a seed from Judah's sons by Shua, except for Shelah, who fathers sons in 1 Chronicles 4, who are described as the house of linen workers at Beth Ashbea, which sounds and looks a lot like Bathsheba. Could this be one more thread tying the women in Matthew's genealogy together for some reason? 1 Chronicles 4:22 also mentions the grandsons of Judah ruled in Moab, which could be a slight reference to Ruth as well. And we hear no more about Shelah's sons. So what is Matthew trying to show us? I see four women who have infidelity in common, but is there something else he is messaging?
Well, I mean, the short answer is, there is more to this. I'll give you, for the sake of this episode, I'll give some seed thoughts. But this is actually a chapter in my forthcoming book, Reversing Hermon, because there are things going on in the genealogy, specifically with these women, that again telegraph this idea that the one who will come, the Messiah, will again undo the effects of the transgression of the Watchers, the Enochian story of Genesis 6. And you think, what does that have to do with the women? Well, that's what the chapter is about. And the chapter is based on a recent dissertation from Marquette. Again, I'll just give the seed thoughts here, because there are some things in that draw these women together. So I think it's appropriate, again, to mention Ruth. And, of course, Bathsheba and whatnot. So I'll just read you a bit of an excerpt. That's probably the easiest way to do this from the new book. So we have here the reference to Tamar, okay? Tamar, or Tamar, is the first of the four women in Matthew's genealogy. That's Matthew chapter 1, of course. And she's known primarily from Genesis 38. Now, the questioner gave a reference to Judah, in Chronicles, but that's hearkening, that's a flashback to Genesis 38, where Tamar deceives Judah, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, into an illicit sexual encounter. We need to recount the story here so that the connection, again, you know, to what would be the watch, what I call in the book, the watcher template, is decipherable. But before I quote that, all of these women have, again, some sort of sexual transgression element involved in their story, either something done to them or something they do, something, you know, again, just in their backstory that is supposed to, as I argue in the book, supposed to draw our attention to the theme of sexual transgression. And then there are things in the text as well that take our minds back in terms of specific vocabulary words back to the episode of Genesis 6, 1 through 4. But I'm not going to get into the nuts and bolts of that here, but let's just go to Genesis 38 just so people can sort of get the context. Genesis 38, starting in the first verse. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. If we skip to verse 12, in the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, in other words, this Canaanite woman, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shears, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep," then she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, and she dresses up like a prostitute. Well, in the verses that we didn't read, and then some of the backstory, Tamar, was the one that had lost a succession of husbands. And the last of Judah's sons, you know, was sort of next in line because of the whole custom of the levirate marriage. And Judah had withheld him from her. And again, it's not just a sexual thing. It's for the purposes of having children, which is tied to inheritance of property and all that kind of stuff. So he has withheld his last son from her because the other ones have died after being married to this woman, to Tamar. So, you know, when Judah's own wife dies, you know, and has a period of mourning, then he goes up to, this particular place where the sheep shears were, and Tamar hears this and she goes, "Okay, I'm gonna get revenge. Essentially, I'm gonna trick him." She dresses up like a prostitute, seduces her own father-in-law, and then of course she gets pregnant by that. We know, or at least I'm assuming we know the rest of the story. You know how she eventually gets vindicated, and he's shown to, you know, have basically betrayed, you know, the thing he should have done was to give her his son and so on and so forth. So we have this whole incident that revolves around this Canaanite woman who was the daughter of Shua. She was Bat, the daughter, okay, of Shua, Bat Shua. So, you know, keep that in mind because that the terminology is going to come up again, and it already did in the question. Now, Bathsheba's name becomes part of this because in 2 Samuel 11, where readers first encounter her, she's called, quote, Bathsheba, Bat-Sheva, the daughter of Eliam. In 1 Chronicles 3:5, she's given a different name. She's called Bat-Shua, the daughter of Amiel. And in Hebrew, the first part of the name, Bat, okay, it means daughter. So the name from 1 Chronicles literally is just like the situation back in Genesis 38. It means daughter of Shua. Which is, you know, the part of the passage we just read. Now, this whole, you know, issue with Bathsheba connecting Judah's situation where this woman in question was a Canaanite, we're not told specifically if Tamar was a Canaanite, but the woman Judah had married was a Canaanite. She's the daughter of Shua. And then we get this going on with Bathsheba, of course, and who gets involved with David. It's because of this that it's possible, scholars have theorized, that Bathsheba was a Gentile, again, was a Canaanite, so that Uriah and Bathsheba were not a mixed couple, a Jew and a Gentile, but they were both Gentiles. And the connection back to Tamar is interesting, again, for the purposes that I deal with in that particular chapter, because if that's the case, and it doesn't, the issue is not so much that these women are Gentiles. We can't prove that all of these women were Gentiles. There are some that for sure are, and there are others that are, you can make an argument, a sort of a peripheral argument like this one, for the possibility anyway. But the real issue is that, you know, not only are they potentially at least two of them, but maybe all four of them sort of another seed, okay, outside the Israelites, that whole idea. But they definitely, all four of them, have something in their background that has to do with an illicit sexual relationship. And that becomes, again, part of the backstory, and in some cases, part of their redemption. In other cases, it's peripheral to them, and someone else, you know, has to have that problem taken care of, and they were victims, that sort of thing. But as I'm going to argue in this chapter of the new book, all of these women are connected by the theme of sexual transgression. And they are, I'll just give you one example. Like Ruth is called a Gevurah, which is the feminine equivalent of Gibor, which is a term that comes from Genesis 6:4. You know, the Nephilim are called Giborim. That doesn't mean anything in terms of her literal physical genealogy. It's just a term that people would have picked up on that would have taken their minds back to the Genesis 6:1 through 4 incident, connecting something in Ruth's heritage, in her story, you know, and you know, Boaz is a Gibor as well, you know, that there are things going on here that connect their backstory to these four verses in Genesis. And you say, well, why does that matter? Well, it matters because this idea that it was because of the sexual transgression of the watchers that they came to earth. And they not only, again, just sort of had this heaven and earth transgression, but they also taught humans how to basically destroy themselves through different points of knowledge. And there are things about, let's say, you know, one of the things in Enoch that's mentioned is makeup and perfumes and all this stuff. You know, well, by themselves, you could look at that and say, well, big deal. Well, those things are often mentioned in biblical stories to portray a seduction incident. Okay, and so that takes the reader's mind again back to, again, this theme of sexual transgression, which sort of gets its kickstart in Genesis 6:1 through 4, or at least the blame for that kind of behavior is laid at the feet of this incident. You know, that becomes the wellspring, the bad wellspring from which people, you know, just go crazy. Again, they take something that in and of itself could be neutral. And some of the things that the watchers, you know, are, you know, quote unquote, you know, teach humans are in other passages, in certain passages, neutral, but they can also lend themselves to destructive behavior and self-destructive behavior. And that's why in Jewish thinking, part of the, again, if we back to our old question, if you ask the average Christian, why is the world the way it is? Why is there so much sin and evil? The only answer you're going to get is Genesis 3. If you asked a first century Jew the same question, they would not say Genesis 3, the fall. They would say that's one element. The other element is Genesis 6, 1 through 4. And the third, you know, element to that is what happened at Babel. So all three of those things frame depravity for a first century Jew, whereas Christians are taught to only think of one of them and exclude the other two. Well, the New Testament writers don't exclude the other two. And so the expectation of the Messiah in between the Testaments and, again, in certain things said in the New Testament, certain episodes, draws on this idea that the Messiah is supposed to be the cure for all of this garbage, all of this depravity that springs from these three incidents, not just this one. And so I don't want to go too much further than that because I really can't do the terminology and the naming issue justice in this, you know, brief description. But at least those are sort of the nuggets, you know. But this is a good catch on the part of the questioner, and it's something that again Hebrew readers would have noticed. And then the question, you know, comes: well, why is it there, and what is the writer trying to intentionally draw attention to? And as we'll see in Reversing Hermon, oftentimes it's this episode, this second segment of the three causes for why the Messiah needed to come.
All right, Rachel in Texas wants to know, after reading your notes on Isaiah 34, I noticed that both Isaiah 34 and Matthew 24 mentioned fig leaves. right after saying that the stars will fall. If the two texts are about the same ideas, would that mean that the fig leaves in Jesus' parable represent the same heavenly beings as they do in Isaiah 34? Do you think that is what Jesus was saying? Could you elaborate on what their coming out and summer is near might mean?
Yeah, well, I would say I wouldn't use the word, you know, like the leaves represent the actual entities. They represent something. They represent something that I do think I would agree with the questioner that is consistent in Isaiah 34. But let's just read the passages so listeners get a feel for the context here. So in Isaiah 34, verse 4, this is what one of the passages that the questioner is alluding to. We read, "All the host of heaven shall rot away, and the skies roll up like a scroll. All their host shall fall, as leaves fall from the vine, like leaves falling from the fig tree." And we spent a good deal of time talking about Isaiah 34 in an earlier episode, where this language, again, it's not just celestial events. There are passages, there are other verses in this passage, but there are other passages that make it clear that at the day of the Lord, when the host of the nations, when they get judged, well, the host of heaven gets judged too. And, you know, it's linking, you know, that basically God's going to clean house, not just on the earth, but also in the spiritual world, in a nutshell. And so it uses this host of heaven shall fall as leaves fall from the vine, like leaves falling from the fig tree. And then in the New Testament, in Matthew 24, and Matthew's not the only place that has this, you get this in Mark 13 as well. But in Matthew 24, verses 29 through 34, I'll read those. "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be dark and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven." Again, stars, very familiar language for divine beings in certain contexts. "And the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and all the tribes of the earth shall mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call. They will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. From the fig tree," verse 32, "learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that the summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." Now, in Matthew, verse 32, fig tree is the Greek word suke, and that is the same term used in Isaiah 34:4 in the Septuagint. So it's very conceivable to me, and again, this isn't unique to me, other scholars are going to say the same thing, that Matthew is drawing on in his description of the second coming here, and of course associated with it all this other stuff, you know, the judgment of the nations and whatnot, that he could be thinking of Isaiah 34:4. I think that you can make a really good case for that Matthew does, and Mark, you know, have Isaiah 34, verse 4 in mind. "The stars are the gods of the nations, the general powers of spiritual darkness that are hostile to God." Again, there's a lot of precedent for that in earlier episodes of the podcast. We've talked about that at length. "They're judged in the final sense. At the day of the Lord, that's when the nations are also judged and believers are put over the nations." In other words, the nations get reclaimed, their gods are finally defeated, and the believers rule the nations of the world in the New Eden on God's behalf. Like in the book of Revelation, chapter 2, chapter 3, toward the end of both those chapters, we see "to him that overcomes," you know, getting put over the nations and ruling the nations with a rod of iron, the messianic language there used of believers. Again, this is all familiar stuff if you've listened to the podcast for any length of time. The point of the fig tree is that it's a useful teaching analogy. Now, I'm going to read a little section here from, I can find it here, from my, this is one of my favorite, this might be my favorite commentary on Matthew. It's by R.T. France. He says, "The fig tree is used because it is the most prominent deciduous tree in Palestine, and one whose summer fruiting was eagerly awaited. The appearance of its new shoots is a clear harbinger of summer. And once they appear, the observer may know for sure how long it will be before the fruit is ready. In the same way, the occurrence of the preliminary events," you know, and France is talking about the preliminary events of, of the Messianic coming, the first century, the sort of the first ground, the already, not the not yet. He says, in the same way, the occurrence of the preliminary events of the first century will inform Jesus' disciples clearly that the process which will end in the temple's destruction is underway and the end is near on the threshold. Now recall, this is me talking now, recall that there are passages, and again, we had this in a whole episode, there are passages that speak of the gods already being defeated. In other words, their rightful status is overturned. Paul is demanding that the Gentiles abandon them, even though God had put them, you know, in charge of the nations. They become corrupt. That's what Psalm 82 is about. God had put them in charge, Deuteronomy 32, 8, 9. Gentiles, though, should now reject them because this, you know, the coming of Jesus and the death, burial, and resurrection, especially the resurrection, signals the fact that it's time for the nations to come back home to the true God and abandon the lesser gods who have become corrupt and are their evil taskmasters. So again, there are passages that talk about the gods already being defeated, but not yet destroyed. Their destruction, their ultimate destruction, is, again, awaiting a future time at the day of the Lord. The same is true of the New Testament tribulation talk. First century believers were and would endure severe tribulation, but even worse tribulation would come right before the eschatological day of the Lord. So I think it's hard for a lot of Bible readers and Bible students to process this kind of stuff. I hate to say it this way, because all they've ever been taught about prophecy is Left Behind. So people who only know this sort of pre-tribulational rapture kind of format. And again, this isn't to exclude the possibility of a rapture. I've said before, I never say that it couldn't be the case, but I don't consider it very likely. But you know, it could be. But if that's all you know, if that's your total framework, there are a lot of things in the Gospels that are going to confuse you. If, on the other hand, your framework is the already but not yet that we talk about a lot on this podcast, then you can see how, okay, some of this stuff Jesus is talking about, or Matthew or Mark or whoever, that was real in their day, and it really did happen to them. But then there are other passages that say that was just a harbinger of something else to come, or you know, that was sort of the template for something else yet to come. You can see fulfillment in their day and fulfillment yet waiting. But if all you're ever trained to think about is whenever somebody says something about that sounds eschatological, it's only future, then you're gonna have a tough time reading the Gospels. And so I just want to throw that out to maybe some listeners that's really the only way they've ever been taught to process eschatology, end times talk. There's an already but not yet thing that flows through most of this stuff. And that's why, you know, we need to pay attention to that. We don't need to be Millers and say everything's already happened, or full preterists or whatever. And we also don't need to be the other side and say, well, nothing's happened, it's all yet future. Actually, the answer is somewhere in between, like there is in so many other cases. So I think the fig leaf thing is just a useful illustration that, again, once you see this, and you're going to see it, you're going to experience what we're talking about here. But if it's tied to Isaiah 34, then the ultimate destruction of the stars of God is associated with the day of the Lord, which has not yet happened. And you can go to the New Testament and talk, you know, even in the Gospels, and see, you know, Jesus and other people talking about the day of the Lord being yet distant, yet future. So it's not that there's a contradiction, it's that we have a both and, not an either or.
Our next question is from Lance, and he wants to know, why did Jesus ask the Father why he forsook him on the cross? Jesus obviously knew what he was doing and why he was doing it. Is it a translation thing, or is it something more esoteric?
Yeah, I think it's a genuine expression of feeling God has forsaken him. I would just say this generally before we want to jump into some things that I think are helpful here. To affirm the humanity of Jesus is not to deny his deity here any more than when he doesn't know what day or hour, you know, he's going to return. So in a nutshell, and I'm going to read a section from an important book about the crucifixion. It's called The Death of the Messiah. It's by Raymond Brown, who was a very famous New Testament scholar, Father Raymond Brown. He was a Catholic scholar, but his specialization was the Gospels. And this is one of the major works on, just like the title says, The Death of the Messiah. But in a nutshell, Jesus knows why he's doing what he's doing, that he's there to defeat the powers of darkness and have the solution for the fact that we have to overcome death and the Lord of the Dead and all this sort of stuff. He knows psalms that are going to be read in hindsight about resurrection. He knows all this stuff, okay? But yet it's a very human thing for him to feel left alone and in despair. He prays in Gethsemane, if it's possible, please, take this cup from me. And, but it turns out it's not. And so when he has to bear the sins of the world and God doesn't intervene and do it a different way, I think this is a genuine expression of despair. Jesus is human. He's not just God. He is God, but he's also human. And this is one of those things where I think we just need to take it at face value and not try to dress it up and pretend it isn't there anymore, like I said a few minutes ago, about Jesus not knowing the precise day or hour that he's going to return. The humanity of Christ shows in different passages in different ways. I think we have an instance of that here. Now, I like the way Brown discusses this. I think he does a nice job of capturing this idea. He says, and this is from The Death of the Messiah, pages 1048 and 1048. This is a massive book. He says, a particular eschatological aspect is the final battle with evil. In language echoing Isaiah 11:4, according to 2 Thessalonians 2:8, the Lord Jesus slays the lawless one with the breath, or the spirit, the pneuma of his mouth. In Acts 8:7, we have this idea of Bo'an or phone megale, this great voice, great sound, to describe the shriek of unclean spirits, as in defeat when they come out of the possessed. So he's comparing this language to the language of Jesus' anguish, when he cries out. Does the violent description of Jesus' outcry, this is Brown now, suggest that in his death struggle with evil, he feels himself on the brink of defeat, so that he must ask why God is not helping him? In any good drama, the last words of the main character are especially significant. It is important for us, then, to ask how literally we should take, my God, for what reason have you forsaken me? Again, quoting from Psalm 22, verse 2. Brown says, there is much to encourage us to take it very literally on the level of the evangelist's portrayal of Jesus. In the tragic drama of Mark and Matthew in the Passion narrative, Jesus has been abandoned by his disciples and mocked by all who have come to the cross. Darkness has covered the earth. There is nothing that shows God acting on Jesus' side. How appropriate that Jesus feel forsaken. His why, the question, is that of someone who has plumbed the depths of the abyss and feels enveloped by the power of darkness. Jesus is not questioning the existence of God or the power of God to do something about what is happening. He is questioning the silence of the one whom he calls my God. If we pay attention to the overall structure of Mark and Matthew in the Passion narrative, that form of addressing the deity is itself significant. For nowhere previously has Jesus ever prayed to God as God. Mark and Matthew begin the Passion narrative with a prayer in which the deity was addressed by Jesus as Father, the common form of address used by Jesus, and one that captured his familial confidence that God would not make the Son go through the hour or to drink the cup. Yet that filial prayer, reiterated three times, was not visibly or audibly answered. And now, having endured the seemingly endless agony of the hour, and having drunk the dregs of the cup, Jesus screams out a final prayer that is an inclusion with the first prayer. Feeling forsaken as if he were not being heard, he no longer presumes to speak intimately to the all-powerful as Father, but employs the address common to all human beings, my God. Brown continues, I'll give you a little bit more of an excerpt here. On theological grounds, some challenge more directly a literal interpretation of Mark and Matthew. The charge is made that to take literally the wording about God forsaking or abandoning Jesus would be to deny Jesus' divinity. Certainly, Mark did not imply such a denial, for immediately after Jesus' prayer in 15:34, we find the climactic confession of Jesus as God's Son. That's Mark 15:39. Still another objection finds despair being attributed to Jesus in a literal interpretation of the prayer. Despair, understood as the loss of hope in God or of salvation, is considered a major sin, and the New Testament affirms that Jesus committed no sin. This is a rather pointless objection, however, for nothing in the Markan passage suggests a sense of the loss of salvation or forgiveness or even the need thereof. Jesus is praying, and so he cannot have lost hope. In other words, if he'd lost hope, why would he pray? Calling God my God implies trust. Because he saw how Jesus died, the Markan centurion confesses that Jesus was God's Son. Mark could not have meant that Jesus' despair prompted such a recognition. Thus, despair in the strict sense is not envisaged. Rather, the issue is whether the struggle with evil will lead to victory. And Jesus is portrayed as profoundly discouraged at the end of his long battle because God, to whose will Jesus committed himself at the beginning of the Passion, has not intervened in the struggle and seemingly has left Jesus unsupported. That this is not true will become apparent the second that Jesus dies. For then God will rend the sanctuary veil and bring a pagan, again the centurion, to acknowledge publicly Jesus' divine sonship. Jesus cries out, hoping that God will break through the alienation he has felt. I'll just stop there with Brown. I think that's really a good description that honors the transparent reading of the text and lets it be what it is. It's a human expression, you know, that we've gone through this whole battle and, you know, like God isn't intervening, but, you know, there are ways to read it and ways to not read it. And Brown goes through the ways to not read it and gives examples from the same passages that contradict flawed conclusions about how we should read this. Again, in that section I just gave you, that's exactly what Brown does. So he's saying there are ways to read this and ways not to read it. And you don't read it certain ways because if you read the whole passage and the things that immediately follow, you'll find out how you're not supposed to read it, how you're not supposed to regard Jesus' despair. But nevertheless, he leaves it in place. He doesn't try to pretend it's not real.
All right, our last question is from Curtis, and his question is, the authorities in Romans 13:1 is exousia. I was wondering your thoughts on Romans 13, Ephesians 6:12, and Isaiah 9:6, and in turn, its relation to the divine counsel, if there is any.
Well, Ephesians 6:12, I think, is evident. You're dealing with, you know, spiritual beings, spiritual forces of darkness. Isaiah 9:6. He's probably referring to the government being upon his shoulders. Again, exousia there wouldn't be, you know, divine beings. It's going to refer to rule, you know, the responsibility, the task, and the you know, the right, the rightful rule. Let's just focus on Romans 13. I think Romans 13, the exousia there, the authorities in the plural, refers to human governing authorities. And there are a few reasons why. First, if we go to the passage, let's just go there, look it up here real quickly. The first verse says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. Okay. Well, every person would include Christians. So having been delivered from the divine powers over the nations, let's just say Gentiles for the, you know, let's just look at Gentile Christians for now. Having been delivered from the divine powers over the nations, the authorities, like, you know, elsewhere, like Ephesians 6:12, it makes little sense for Paul to tell them, to tell Gentile believers to then be subject to them again. And even less sense if we're talking about Jewish believers in Jesus, for whom that they were never even under these spiritual authorities. They had only one authority, the God of Israel. So it doesn't make any sense to view them as, again, spiritual powers of darkness there, and for Paul to be telling Christians to submit themselves to spiritual powers of darkness. It just doesn't make any sense theologically. Again, the term itself can be very generic in other contexts of just ruling authorities in terms of human rulers, and that's the way I take it. Second reason I would say that is that the description of the rulers here in Romans 13 doesn't match the description of the gods of the nations, like in Psalm 82 or other passages. It just doesn't match, because in those passages, it's very evident that they're corrupt and they're evil and they're wicked. They do the opposite of what Paul describes in Romans 13, that the powers here, the powers that be, are to reward, you know, righteousness and to punish evil. That's not at all what, again, the gods of the nations were doing. That's, in fact, it's the opposite. And thirdly, I would say that the reference in Romans 13 to not bearing the sword in vain is a clear reference to earthly punishment of criminals in that day. It's a very familiar term. So I really don't think there's any good reason in Romans 13 to view the exousia there in that passage as the gods of the nations, and the principalities and powers.
All right, Mike, that's all the questions we have for this one. So we appreciate you answering our questions. And next week, we're back into Ezekiel. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add for this show?
No, I think that's good. Those were good questions. You know, keep the questions coming. We are chipping away at them, and we'll do the best we can with them.
All right. Well, that sounds good, Mike. All right. Well, I want everybody to have a happy new year and a good 2017. This is our last episode of 2016. It was a good one. So only more good things to happen in 2017, and we look forward to it. And again, Mike, thanks for answering our questions. And I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.